call the order, Judiciary House. Move too quick. What's the date today? 27th, February 27th at 3:06. And what we have in front of us today is we've got some confirmation interviews to do on the phone, and then we'll be moving to HB 83. And then to HB 33, and finally to HB 104. The reason I'm pointing that out is we have several online, Patty McGuire and Alpheus. I want to promise you that we will not get to HB 104 before 2 o'clock. So if you have other things to do and want to call back at 2, you won't miss anything. You're welcome to stay on. And I, other than that, we can, I believe, press on. We got with us today Representative Pruitt, Representative Lynn, and Representative Ledoux, and myself, Representative Keller. I suspect we'll be joined shortly by several others. So, with that, I think we'll. There's one other thing I want to housekeeping before we go any further. On your desk in front of you, on your tabletop, is a language of for a letter of intent that was suggested for House Bill 63 to follow House Bill 63, which we passed out last time. If you can read it at some point, I'll remember to ask if there's any objection. And what you're approving is basically the language of the letter, not the format or anything like that. So with that, I think we got the house odds and ends done. We'll go to Jared Godfrey first. Jared, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm online.
Thank you very much, both, for being willing to serve on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board and for taking time to call and talk to us on Judiciary. So, if you would, just introduce yourself, state your name, and you know, just give us whatever prepared statement you may have, you know, hopefully why you want to serve on the board. Go ahead.
My name is Jared Godfrey. I live in Eagle River, Alaska. I have served on the board, I'm 10 years on the board, and I said last time that this would be my last confirmation hearing, and alas, here I am. So this time I mean it. I've served on the board, as I said, for a number of years, and it's been very gratifying work, having had family members that were innocent victims of violent crime. I've learned a lot and seen a lot and have had the good fortune of serving on a board that is able to help a lot of Alaska residents in their time of need due to being victims of violent crime. I've had the opportunity to spend a good deal of time in juvenile, every session, visiting with legislators and sharing with them the issues of innocent victims of violent crime in the state of Alaska, talking about statistics and legislation that would further help us advocate for innocent victims of violent crime. And with that, that's all I have.
Oh, Jared, thank you so much for your brevity and concise. Is there any questions for Jared? And we've been joined by Representative Grunberg, and what we're doing is confirmations here on for the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, Representative Grunberg, and he just explained.
No, I don't have any questions. Okay. Have we taken up other people too, or is he the first?
No, first one. So I see no other questions, so what we're doing is our action today will be to move your name forward to the full body and, you know, giving you the opportunity to talk to us. So, you know, what we do today is not a confirmation anyway. It's just moving your name along. So thanks for calling in, Jared.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
William Gordon, are you online?
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chair.
Okay, William, you put your name in for the Board of Governors for the Alaska of the Alaska Bar. Again, thank you for being willing to do that, and we're hoping you could explain why. And we may have questions, but if you would just go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you very much. I do notice there aren't any members on the committee from Fairbanks, so I thought the industry is here to most of you. I'm a lifetime Alaskan. I've served in the private sector most of my life, but with some public agents also. My interest in this particular agency is twofold, and the short version is one is that as a member of the consumer of services from the legal industry over the years and my businesses and all through. Secondly, it's the knowledge that I've gained through 6 years of service as a member of the Alaska Judicial Council. That time provided me the opportunity to interview, I guess, literally hundreds of top attorneys from around the state who put themselves through that very difficult process, and learned a lot about attorneys, their unique profession, the rules they live by, the rules they make for themselves through the Board of Governors, and some of the frustrations of their jobs. And when the term ended, I chose not to stand for the appointment to the Judicial Council, but some people who apparently were interested in continuing to serve and encouraged me to put my name up for this position. Frankly, I wasn't even aware there were public members of the Board of Governors until they came to me, but since I've served a couple of meetings now, I've learned that we can be helpful, so I'm happy to put my name forward for your consideration.
Thank you, William. Looks like Representative Grimberg has a question for you.
This is for the Board of Governors?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this is Mr. Gordon?
Yes.
Mr. Gordon, I take it you were on the Commission on Judicial Conduct before this.
No, I've never served on that. There was some interest in my service on that following up the Judicial Council, but I think the Board of Governors seemed to be the better fit.
I see. So the resume that we have, though it lists Commission on Judicial Conduct,
That first came in and, back when there was a vacancy on that commission that subsequently was filled, and the suggestion was made I put my name in for Board of Governors. So
I do have a question.
I'm sorry for that confusion.
Representative Grimberg has a question for you.
Okay. There has been some controversy over the years as to whether the Bar Association should be under the legislature or under the judiciary. And the position is that because it involves the practice of law, it should be regulated by the judiciary and not, for example, having its budget run through the legislature under the Executive Budget Act. I happen to think that's a good idea. I think most lawyers in this state would agree that it should be under the judiciary. However, from time to time, there's been an effort, at least with legislation introduced or at least bandied about, that would move it under the legislature and make the Board of Governors and the Bar subject to the Executive Ethics Act. Do you have a position on that issue?
It would be a somewhat presumptuous of me to take one with my only serving, having served two meetings, but I have been educated to some degree in those meetings, so that it does appear that the Bar Association, while it is a licensing agency of the state and created by statute, does operate out of the Executive Budget Act. I mean, it sets its own budget, it hires its own staff, and collects its own revenue. And, of course, it answers directly right now to the Supreme Court. Any action we take, whether it's disciplinary or new rules or something like that, is always subject to the approval of the court. And so we're kind of floating out there. We of course, come under sunset review by the legislature. That seems to be absolutely what should happen if we're created statutorily. So I don't have a position, Representative Grimberg, on your question, because I just don't know enough yet.
I appreciate that. I hope you will recall, as you go through your service on the board, this conversation, because I think most lawyers feel fairly strongly that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And we work well under the Supreme Court, so maybe keep that in mind. That's just my own views, and other lawyers may disagree, but I don't think too many will. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
I don't see any other questions this time. William, again, thank you very much. We're honored that you took time to come down and talk to us.
Well, I appreciate your time also. Thank you.
Adam Trombley, are you online? Adam, again, Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar.
but...
Okay, we'll come back if he shows up. Robert, I'm going to try. It's Gross Close, is it?
Gross Close.
Yeah. Robert, are you online?
Yes, I am here, Mr. Chairman. Bob Gross Close in Fairbanks.
And you are interested in the Commission of Judicial Conduct, and if you would, go ahead and give us a statement about why you want to do it, and we'll see if there's any questions from the committee.
I've been a member of the Alaska Bar since 1976. I've served over the past three-plus decades in various Bar Association capacities. Served on the Judicial Council 2000 to 2006. In fact, I overlapped with the past presenter there, Bill Gordon. And like Bill has kind of expressed, but being a practicing lawyer, I see the value that our judiciary has had and the function it serves in the state on the Judicial Council end of the street, the selection process I would put at a level second to none in the nation, and I am happy to give of my time to look and to assure that judicial performance comports with the level of excellence that we've set in place in our state, and the Judicial Conduct Commission is handles that end of the block, where they oversee performance at that level. So I'm happy to give up my time in that way. I think as a lawyer and as an Alaskan, we all benefit by having a strong judiciary, and one that we can all be proud of, and I think all of us have a part to play in that to keep it going, and what I can do, I'm happy to do.
Thank you so much. We have a question from Representative Greenwood.
Mr. Grossclose, I'm glad you're applying for this position. Bob and I have known each other since we both worked for Ted Stevens in the early 1970s. I noticed that you didn't put that on your resume.
I should have, Max. I didn't know that I needed to be that involved with my resume, but no, Ted Stevens, I'm sure to you was to me very much a mentor and someone who, as Ted often liked to so succinctly put it, to hell with politics, let's do what's right for Alaska. And I think all of us with a focus on public service in Alaska need to make that our credo, and I certainly want to carry that forward in any work on the Judicial Conduct Commission. Let's do what's right for judges, and let's do what's right for the people of the state.
Yeah, I approve, if I may dialogue for a minute with my friend here.
Representative Greenberg.
And for the record, your wife, Barbara Schumann, was on the staff of Senator Marlo Cook from Kentucky at the time, so you come from a family of people who've done a lot of public service. You and your wife and everybody, and on behalf of all of us, I want to thank you. I think it's great what you're doing. I think you'd be good on the Judicial Conduct Commission. It's important, and I'm going to harken back to my conversation a minute ago with Bill Gordon, that your commission, just like the Bar Association and the Judicial Commission, a Judicial Council, retain their constitutional independence, and that your counsel, with Marla Greenstein and her assistant, have, I think, the smallest budget. She was saying the other day on the in front of the House Finance Subcommittee on the courts, that of any constitutional entity, and I think it is most important that you retain your independence in the budgeting process to run that council as you need to. Any comments on your need for, you see a need for you to maintain your independence as a constitutionally separate entity?
I would agree. I think it's one of those hallmarks that goes back to our, not just our state constitution, but certainly we're the mirror image of what we do on the federal level, and our country's been well served by a separate judiciary and needs to maintain that check and balance.
Can you take follow-up, Representative Bloomberg?
Thank you.
You bet. Go ahead.
I am going somewhere with this. You'll see in a minute here. When you, your counsel, disciplines a judge, it can either be, through the Supreme Court, I guess. At some point in the process, the decision becomes final and public. When does that occur?
I assume it's going to happen upon action by the commission if the decision is of a public nature, which frankly I haven't been down the path yet in serving to where those sort of intricacies are known by me, and you're sort of reminding me it's something that I certainly am going to be schooled in if I don't school up on it before I serve.
I didn't know, through the chair, I didn't know if it becomes public before it goes to the Supreme Court for final action or afterwards. I take it you don't know either.
I don't know positively. No, I do not.
Does the council have a duty or a custom to publicizing the results of a public action against a judge? Do you do any advertising? I don't recall seeing anything like that in the council's budget.
I'm unaware of that. Having been in the state for many decades, I think it's more of a news reporting outlet. It's not, and there's likely, well, I know there's information sharing that is made with the judicial council in terms of retention election processing. So information about a judge's performance commonly is made known through the judicial council's retention process. If a judge's conduct draws that judge into question before retention, how information about that's disseminated, I frankly don't know. My assumption is it's a little bit like lawyers who get in trouble. If the admonition becomes public, there is a news release to that effect. But beyond that, I don't know that it amounts to much.
If I may continue briefly.
Representative.
I'm going into an area that I think is extremely important. You've been on the Judicial Council, right?
I have.
Okay. And under the Judicial Council's functions, they publish and advertise the results of surveys, the record of the judges, et cetera, for retention, and you have an advertising budget for that purpose, right?
If I could just interrupt. The judicial conduct, the commission, is very different than what the Judicial Council does. So tell me where you're going.
I want to ask one or two questions because this gentleman has been on the Judicial Council and there's going to be, or has been, some potential threat to the Judicial Council's advertising budget.
And that has nothing to do with confirmation that I can see on the Judicial Conduct Commission.
That is correct. I would like to ask one or two questions to get that on the record. It is extremely important and is likely to come up later today.
Yeah, please get to your questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Did you hear my question, Mr. Gross-Close?
Could you rephrase it? Repeat it, I'm sorry.
Yeah. On the Judicial Council, there's an advertising budget to publicize the results of the surveys and the council's research in a retention election.
Yes, there is.
Do you think that's an important function of the council?
I do.
Okay. Thank you very much, because we're likely to see that become an issue in the budget process, and I am extremely concerned about that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving me a latitude to ask a couple of questions on that very important subject.
You're welcome, Representative.
Appreciate it, Lewis.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Gross-Close. Good to talk to you.
Is there any other questions here? I don't see any Thanks so much for calling in, Robert, and appreciate your time. And again, the action that we're going to take in the committee today is whether to pass the name on for consideration by the whole body. It's not a approval or disapproval. So thanks for calling in.
All right. Thank you.
Adam Trombley.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, okay, good. I guess you're interested in being on the Board of Governors for the Alaska Bar, and we would like to hear your response on why you want to do that, and give us your testimony you probably have prepared. Introduce yourself first for the record.
My name is Adam Trombley. I live in Anchorage. I'm a member of the Anchorage Assembly. I represent East Anchorage. And I had approached some individuals with involved in the state
Can you talk a little closer to the mic, or?
I'm sorry. Do you want me to repeat everything I just said?
Yes.
Repeat everything.
It's still pretty weak. If you heard better, it was fine, but
I don't know if it's. I'm right up against the phone, so.
Okay. We'll listen carefully, and we can hear you, so go ahead.
Okay, I'll just repeat it. My name's Adam Trombley. I live in Anchorage. I'm a member of the Anchorage Assembly. I represent East Anchorage. And about a year or so ago, I had approached some individuals with the governor's office and just expressed a desire to be involved in state issues. I was appointed by Mayor Sullivan in 2009 to be on the Budget Advisory Commission. I enjoyed that work, and I thought I'd also enjoy doing some work on the state level as well. In any capacity, I really wasn't specific towards which board. And when I was approached with the Board of Governors, I've always had an interest in law. Being on the Assembly, we deal with, obviously we deal with law all the time because we're legislators, we pass laws. But at the same time, we also have to understand state law to see if what we can and can't do is within our authority. And so I thought that would help broaden the base to help serve my constituents as far as understanding the legal aspects and getting to know additional more attorneys in the state and understand the difference between what goes on in Anchorage from a legal standpoint to the rural areas as well, because that's a huge function, and we see a huge increase or a huge migration sometimes from people from the bush and some of the legal challenges that come along with that. But I think being involved in this helps me also better understand what goes on in the bush areas. And again, I have a large Native Alaskan population in the district that I do represent. So it just helps me serve them in a better capacity. That's all.
Thank you for being willing. Any questions? Representative Gruenberg has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mr. Trombley is my assembly person, and we know each other. And Adam, I'm glad you're doing this. I know you'll do a good job.
Well, thank you. I appreciate we've had a chance to work together in the past on some laws regarding taxi cab drivers, and I appreciate you testifying on behalf of me and just kind of providing greater clarity for that.
Well, thanks for asking. I had a good time, and hopefully it was helpful. A couple of things. You heard me ask Bill Gordon about the independence of the bar from legislative control and being under the judiciary. Do you recall, were you on the line when I asked Mr. Gordon those questions?
No, sir, I was not.
Oh, okay. The Board of Governors, the Bar Association, is under the Supreme Court, and it passes its budget through the court system. I mean, it's under their direction and administration. From time to time, there has been an effort to make the bar under legislative control, under the control of the state legislature, like executive agencies are, and to specifically require that they do their budgeting through the legislature under the Executive Budgeting Act. I don't support that. I don't think most lawyers support that. We think it's working well the way it is. What is your feeling on that, if any?
I do appreciate the separation. Obviously, I can see the other side of it, but all of the recommendations that we make, whether it's censure of an attorney, the disciplinary measures that the board will pass upon an attorney, has to get approved by the Supreme Court anyways. And so, in my mind, since every recommendation we make, whether it's changes to the rules of the bar or rules of the court, or censure or disciplinary measures to attorneys, since all of those things automatically go to the Supreme Court, I think it would be, I think for consistency's sake, sending everything there from a budgetary standpoint would be important as well. That's just my personal feeling.
If I may continue, Mr. Chair.
One more question?
I have a couple more, two different subjects.
Okay,
sorry, I yield to the representative.
No, go finish yours and then...
Okay, sorry. I have a question on two separate other issues. Heard from the Bar Association a couple of days ago when we had a House bill in front of us that would extend the Board of Governors for another 8 years, I believe. 8 years, yeah. So we had Steve Van Goor and the president of the Bar Association, Hannah. Deborah is the executive director. Hannah Siebold is the president of the Bar. She's a lawyer here from Juneau, but Hannah and Steve testified before us. And we talked to some extent about mandatory continuing legal education. And right now, the only mandatory continuing legal education, or MCLE, is 3 hours of ethics CLE a year, and hopefully an aspirational goal, voluntary, of 9. But whether that should be increased to make certain that lawyers keep up with the technical advances in the law. And I strongly support that, and we'll be, hopefully, Mr. Chair, looking at this letter of intent, which will accompany the bill in a few minutes. Do you support additional mandatory CLE for members of the bar?
I don't specifically object. I don't object to it on any reasonable grounds, but I will say from the things that I've read just in the short period of time that I've been involved with the Board of Governors is that a lot of attorneys seem to actually go above and beyond already that limit of 3 continuing, the CRE, they already go above and beyond that limit. So I'm not opposed to raising it, but I do need additional information before I can speak with any real authority on the issue.
Yeah, that's through the chair. That's fair enough. I don't propose to say I speak for other lawyers. I think a lot of them feel the way I do. A lot of them feel the other way. The other person, I don't know. And finally, there is developing a new multi-state bar exam that if you pass it in one state and you apply in another state within a certain period of time, maybe 2 years or 5 or something, that you don't have to take the bar exam in the second state. You use the results from this new multi-state bar exam, and it will certainly help people become more portable in their practice, be able to represent clients easier in multi-state or interstate matters and stuff. And it's a really, I think, a very important step in the right direction. And I don't know that the Board of Governors has looked at that yet or has made a decision. I certainly, as one of your people, constituents, one of your lawyers, would strongly support that. Any comments through the chair?
We did address it at the meeting in January. The board doesn't like the idea, and I can understand why. In Alaska, we don't have a law school. And because we don't have a law school, if people go to law school, you know, they're going to Washington or Oregon or wherever else around the country, there's no specific education in a law school in, say, North Dakota that deals with Alaska law. So I understand having a separate bar exam just for Alaska because there are things that are going to focus on the needs of solely Alaska. At the same time, I understand the reverse being true, that if you go to law school, you pass a national bar exam, I can see how you would be credited, and maybe you could, maybe there's an additional step that could be implemented where, you know, before you practice here, you got to have some sort of training or something on Alaska law. I can see something like that possibly happening, but the Bar Association dealt with it. We, as a body, we didn't necessarily agree with it. And just for that very reason, that there's nothing in lower 48 law schools that deal specifically with Alaska law. And as you guys know, you know, sitting in Juneau, kind of isolated to some degree, that's a lot of Alaska. A lot of Alaska is isolated. And I think there should be specific training and specific examples and testing for Alaska law. I think that's important.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Trombley is also my representative in the Anchorage Assembly, so I've enjoyed working with him. Also, so I'll just ditto Representative Grunberg's remarks. And this is actually more directed to Representative Grunberg, if you'll indulge me, than it is to Mr. Trombley.
Okay, Mr. Trombley, you can close the ears if you want.
Right, I'm on mute. Got it.
I guess I'm just wondering whether the question of how somebody feels philosophically about whether or not the Bar Association should be under the judiciary or whether it should be under the purview of the legislature, is that actually, let's just say that somebody had said, hey, it should be under the purview of the legislature. What difference does that make to their qualifications to serve on the Board of Governors? Does it make anything?
If it's okay, I'd like to stop, you know, and say, unless you really have a burning desire, you don't have to have that. The reason is that it is off the field from where we're going. It's germane in getting to know these people. But you're right. It's not a litmus test here and I'm glad you're putting it on the record, because that is not the intent of this committee, is to put a litmus test out there. But it's okay. We try not to restrict questions, because it builds a relationship and interaction, in an unofficial kind of way here, but it's on the record, that is helpful to all of us. So unless you... Does that satisfy you, or would you like to...
I think that satisfies me. I just wasn't sure whether the Board of Governors would be making that decision for themselves, and I didn't think that they would.
No, I think it would have more to do with the appropriators. But
the Chair, it's an excellent question. I don't have an objection to answering it.
No, I do.
Oh, you do? Oh,
yeah. Just because of time, with all due respect. It's a great topic.
I appreciate very much the way you allow us to ask questions. I really do.
And I don't want to get in the spot of, I'm not doing that. So, Adam, again, thank you for taking time. We're really grateful on several levels. One, that you're willing to serve the state in this way. There's literally hundreds of commissions out there and dedicated Alaskans like yourself have a lot more to do with the governance of Alaska, I think, than most people realize. And I am grateful. Thank you all.
All right. Well, thank you to everybody.
Representative Grunberg, did you have one more thing to add?
No, not to him. It's more a response, if I could, for a moment, to what we've just been talking about.
Okay.
I view the legislature's confirmation responsibility in a very broad sense, and we can vote to confirm or deny confirmation for any reason, valid or invalid, and because the Constitution requires us to confirm heads of departments and independent agencies, it's very relevant, I think, for us to explore the person's relevant legal philosophy in this particular
case. Like I say, we won't explore that right now, but it's very tempting. I mean, I'd love to talk, but we're going to stop there. Does anyone have a motion or two on these names?
Mr. Chairman, are you ready for a motion?
Yeah.
I would move that we send forward the names of Jared Godfrey for the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and William Gordon for the Board of Governors of Alaska Bar, and Adam Trombley, Board of Governors of Alaska Bar, Robert Gruslos, Commission for Judicial Conduct, to send those names to the full body to be heard for a conference hearing before a joint session of our legislature.
Seeing no objection, they press on. And there's a paper going around, we'll sign. But we're going to go right into with.
Could we perhaps take this up as unfinished business and just get it?
Yeah, there? We will. I brought it up. I've been glad you said that, Representative Grunberg. We have a letter of intent language that goes with HB 63 and on your desk. And before you came, it was, you know, well, remind me before we're done, but we're not going to take it up right now.
I'll make the appropriate motion if you want.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, okay. So anyway, with the indulgence of the committee, we're going to go to HB 83. As you know, we put that aside a little bit, and I'm going to ask my staff to come up and introduce the bill to you. Identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Let me get caught up here, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Pound, staff to Representative Wes Keller. Before you, use House Bill 83, you've certainly had a lot of discussion in the last few days on issues coming out of Washington, D.C. that have to do with statutes, regulations, executive orders, secretarial orders, so I won't go into the details of that. Essentially, House Bill 83 is sort of a process bill. It is a process that when the Attorney General, in his or her regular review of federal statutes, federal regulations, executive orders, and secretarial orders, comes across one that he or she feels was improperly filed or is unconstitutional, they will advise out of the Attorney General's office the chair of the Judiciary Committees in both houses. At that time, if the Judiciary Chair brings it before the Committee of the Judiciary, there can be a decision by the Committee if they decide that they would like to nullify or at least state that this bill is, this language is not going to be upheld in Alaska. It's a process of nullification. Essentially what it boils down to is the Judiciary Committee of either House or both Houses would in fact introduce legislation to nullify a specific statute, federal statute, regulation, executive order, or secretarial order, and it would go through the entire process, and then that would be sent back to Washington as a statute that it is not going to be identified in the state. That is what HB 83 does. It is the process of nullification the way it's supposed to be done. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for the sponsor staff or myself?
I have looked at this in the past, but I don't recall, and I'm not up to speed. Would you explain once again what this thing does?
Essentially,
pardon, with due respect, I'm sorry.
Through the chair, Mr. Grimm, essentially what will happen is the Attorney General will take a look at either a federal statute, federal regulation, an executive order, or a secretarial order. There's two processes that can be determined there, whether it was properly filed or properly processed at the federal level, or whether it's constitutional or not. If the Attorney General determines either one of those, of any one of those items, that information will be provided in a report to the Judiciary of both Houses. The Judiciary Committee of both Houses can then determine whether they wish to proceed to attempt to nullify that by introducing legislation into this respective House and passing it through the process and having it signed by the governor, at which time it essentially will say that the particular reg, statute, executive order, or secretarial order is not going to be identified in Alaska as law.
If I could, just a clarification, is that it doesn't lay down the procedure by which or anything about how the judiciary acts. That's an option that we have, but the bill doesn't do that. So
Mr. Chairman, it basically just a notification?
That's right. Thank you, yes, for that question.
Mr. Chair. I'd like you to look at one word. By the way, do we have other people who are going to testify on this?
Right now we're into the questions. We don't have any testimony yet. I haven't seen anybody. Yes, we have one caller online that wants to speak to the bill.
Do we have anybody from law?
We do, but he was on for 104, so probably not.
Well, my question.
Part of the reason is we had heard this before last year. You had heard it before last year. It's the very same bill, if it's any comfort to you, that we passed last year. But go ahead.
Okay. One word here. And I think at some point I'd like to hear from the Department of Law because of this, and this relates directly to their fiscal note.
Word.
Okay, it is section 4 of the bill, page 2, line 26. This is under the duties of the Attorney General. Can I have Title 44, please? It says, the Attorney General shall continue to review, blah, blah, blah. And then on the fiscal note from law, it just quotes that on the second page, just quotes that that provision in the bill. It does not take a position on whether that's directory or mandatory. A shall can be read two ways. It can be read to designate who does something. On the one hand, that's a directory. That's a directive. That rather than the Commissioner of Natural Resources, it's the Attorney General. On the other hand, it can be read as mandatory, shall versus may. And this is a little different because it brings a third dimension to that phrase. It's not shall review, shall continue to review. And that would seem to possibly indicate that they shall continue to do what they're doing, and it does not impose any greater duty on them than they currently have. But if you take a look at 4423020, that uses in a number of places there the word shall, like in subsection B, defend the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. Those phrases would seem not to be directory but mandatory, that they defend the Constitution, not somebody else, but that they must defend the Constitution. Although there, it's been read in some cases, the public defender case and stuff, that they have the discretion not to do it. Now, if in fact they're supposed to review every law, regulation, et cetera, that's a terrific burden, and I don't see that that can have a zero fiscal note on that. I know we have the vice chair of the Finance Committee listening to every word here. But seriously, what is the intent? Is it directory or mandatory?
Yeah, it's a little uncomfortable being the chair and responding to you, but I think this might satisfy you, and that is that the shall continue means to continue on with the process that they have in place. And to put on the record, there's neither any sponsor intent that we impose a higher burden on the Department of Law other than to report to us when they make a determination. And it's certainly not what the Department of Law expects, or we wouldn't have the zero fiscal note, as you know. So this has been discussed, you know, but not in this context. I appreciate you putting it on
the
record.
Okay, so just for the record, it does not require them to review everything, but if they find something that's unconstitutional, they must report it.
Yes.
Okay, with that, I would ask, and I'm not trying to delay the bill, because even though I may or may not support it, I think you have the votes to do that and you want to do it. But I think it is important that somebody from law, and I'd like to see it in this committee if we could do it, go over this fiscal note to the extent, would that additional burden of writing reports cause a different fiscal note? I want that on the record one way or the other. I know that's a finance issue, but I think for us to do the job on this, we need to at least have somebody testify. Maybe Don Blaisdell or somebody from the administrative arm in the Department of Law.
Annie, I won't call you on the spots. I didn't say that on the record, did I?
Well, I wasn't thinking anything. I was thinking somebody from the, I'm on the Department of Law subcommittee, too. I think it needs some administrator to do this rather than, unless she wants to do it.
I'm not assigned to Bill. Dave Jones is.
I would request that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be good. So my staff will try to see if he's available online. So is there any other further questions first, besides that for myself or the sponsor? And then
I'm going to say I don't think I'm going to object, but I want to be sure, sure we sure. really know what we're
It'll
getting.
It'll be on the record that way, and that's great.
Yeah. Okay.
So we'll go to public testimony. Mike Coons, are you online waiting to testify?
Yes, sir, I am.
Go right ahead. Just state your name and who you represent. And did you call in for 83 or 33? My paperwork here, I may have misread it. I am very sorry.
83, sir.
Which one, 33?
83, what we're doing. Yes. Okay, my name is Mike Coons. I'm from Palmer, Alaska, and I'm speaking for myself. In regards to lines 7 through 9, maybe the following will assist Representative Grunberg in understanding the need for this bill and why nullification is right and just. Since last hearing, he is the issue on nullification. The general misconception is that any statute passed by legislatures bearing the appearance of law constitutes the law of the land. The U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and any statute to be valid must be in agreement. It is impossible for a law which violates the Constitution to be valid. This is subsequently stated as follows by Supreme Court rulings. All laws which are repugnant to the Constitution are null and void. Marbury versus Madison. When rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Miranda versus Arizona. An unconstitutional act is not law. It confers no rights, it imposes no duties, affords no protection, it creates no office. It is in legal contemplation as inoperative as though it had never been passed. Norton versus Shelby County. Thus, nullification of any federal statutes, executive orders, secretarial orders, or department regulations that violate the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and the follow-on constitutional amendments is right and just. For too long, our state, as well as other predominantly Western states, have endured the theft of our lands, the regulating away of our jobs and industries. All but a handful of people in a faraway place that have no idea who we are, our lands, how we husband those lands, and the impact their short-sighted but long-reaching actions have impacted our land and our people. Jimmy Carter stole Alaska from not only us Alaskans, but all Americans. Then Governor Knowles refused to go forward with the Katie John lawsuit that would have overturned that land grab. This bill has the potential to stop further land grabs and erosion of our rights under the 10th Amendment and may help in the future regaining our lands. I urge full support of HB 83 and immediate passage out of this committee and passage on the floor of the House, and I thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you so much, Mike. Any questions for Mike? Representative Lynn?
Right. I'm not an attorney. Maybe Mike may not be able to help me. Somebody else in the committee can. Can any law be, quote, unconstitutional, unquote, until the Supreme Court of a state or the United States Supreme Court says it's unconstitutional? Do you follow me?
Would you like to respond to that, Mike? We'll give you a first shot at it.
Or anybody on the committee for that
sure.
matter.
Sirs, Representative Lynn, I think what the intent of this bill is that the Attorney General for the state of Alaska will be looking at any federal law, regulation, executive order, secretarial order, and the Attorney General, who is far more knowledgeable on the Constitution than I, would be able to sit down, work it out, develop a report, and give to this committee and to the Judiciary Committee in the Senate their finding that it is indeed unconstitutional. So I think that would cover that aspect without having to wait for a state Supreme Court ruling or going on up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if it does make this go to the U.S. Supreme Court, that I would think that once Alaska turns around and says we're nullifying this, then the federal government has the right to take it up to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court would hear it and rule it, and we would take it from there. Does that answer your question, Representative Wynn?
I think it helped, through the chair. But can an attorney general's opinion match that of the opinion of one of the Supreme Courts? In other words, does his opinion, is that the same as a Supreme Court calling it unconstitutional or deciding it's unconstitutional?
I'll give that back to the chairman on that one.
Mike, I thank you.
I'm just trying to get educated.
I thank you for calling in very much. And yeah, I won't be able to respond, and I see Representative Grunberg has a comment too. But the issue of the bill is really, it's about interpretation of the Constitution. And the statement being made in this bill is that the federal government, whether it be the Supreme Court or not, does not hold a monopoly on interpreting the Constitution. And that is, that's a loaded question. We could spend a lot of time, as we already have, discussing and exploring that. But the truth of the matter is that that is what it's all about, is who can interpret what the Constitution says. And there's been a lot of folks that believe that it's as much the legislator's responsibility to make that interpretation as the courts. However, the courts and the federal government have a lot bigger guns, and it can be a very painful process if we leave the impression that we're defying what the federal court says, then of course it's a tough call. But
I can see, Mr. Chairman, that the opinion of the Attorney General would be valid enough for it to be reported to the Judiciary Committee to take whatever action they would choose to do so. And the final arbiter of this, of course, would be the state or the federal constitution. But I'm comfortable with the Attorney General giving his opinion that it may be unconstitutional and then reporting that to the Judiciary Committees in each body.
Right. Thank you. Representative Grunberg, I'm sure, has a comment. And I want to say for the record, Representative Millett has joined us, and Representative Foster is excused. And I forget.
Sorry for being late. I had a bill in resources.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Grunberg.
I can see that this bill may have some benefit, just as the Legislative Affairs Agency Office of Legal Counsel's report annually does. I think that has some benefit. To that extent, I think that it's a good idea. Going beyond that, I have problems with, because this is the state's attorney, and really it's an appointed position, not an elected position, and I'm not saying it should be elected, but you got to figure where everybody's coming from in this world.
Yeah.
And what one person may feel is unconstitutional, another may not, and that's why lawyers are very conservative when they offer legal advice. They rarely say it's black and white or black or white. I don't know how wedded you are to the current language, but just adding to 4423020, which is the duties of the Department of Law, and they list about nine duties. They don't specifically say that they shall report to the legislature, if they find something's unconstitutional. You have here in subsection 8 the germ of something that really does that. The other language, I think, is going to be a lot more controversial in section 0110200, for example, may not be considered to preempt a state law. That is going to be somewhat vague in how a court would interpret that language, how the Department of Law would consider. We don't usually say is considered, and that's not a direction or otherwise it might be a tautology, you know? I don't see... I don't see really a problem with Section 3 here. That just allows the committees to consider the report, and I think that's a good idea, too, you know? I would prefer, and I realize I'm sort of getting ahead of us a little bit here, but for what it's worth, that we make this so it's really clean, strong thing, because I think what you really want to do is to...
Representative Grunberg, if we'll close public testimony for now, because there's nobody else in the room and nobody else in line. If you have an amendment to make to the bill as it's out there, then please go ahead and do it. But we can do that at the time we're discussing.
I was just kind of talking. I think I might if I'd have to talk to you and see your feeling because you're the sponsor of the bill, and Mr. Pound, whoever you is.
And on the original question that you asked about how much it would cost the Department of Law to make the report to I've been thinking back on the record, and I think what I'm remembering, and maybe my staff can help me out here, is that I think because it doesn't specify that it has to be a printed copy or anything, it's more a notification. They determined last year when we heard this bill, and it went easily through Judiciary Committee when we heard it. I think that's how that was resolved and the reason why the zero fiscal note was there. With your, if you're satisfied with that, you know, because the Assistant Attorney General is not available right now, we will, proceed. So
I'm okay. I don't have an amendment in my pocket on this at the moment. Yeah. I'm happy to do that.
Yeah.
Whatever you want. I'll leave it at, we see a lot of these bills coming through the Department of Law subcommittee, each time we challenge a law or somebody makes us enforce it, it's not a cheap process.
Okay. Does anyone else have a question, or would anybody else on the committee have a comment on the bill, number one, or a question on the bill? And would you like to...
Mr. Chairman, I support the bill. Are you ready for a motion?
I am. I'm uncomfortable walking past, leaving questions on the table, but I don't see the questions as being significant with due respect myself. But I want the rest of the – I don't want to put you in a bad spot. I'll tell you what. We'll put this bill aside for another
– Wait.
Sorry. I know that. Thanks.
I'm perfectly comfortable with it.
I'd like to talk with you.
Okay, off the record, just a little bit.
I could see this being a very clean bill, simple, and something that people would appreciate on both sides of the aisle. And if maybe after we're finished with this, we can talk for a few minutes.
Representative Grunberg, I will keep this until... till Friday, we'll see what we come up with. And if in the meantime, if you have any other questions that come up, please talk to me and we'll work it through.
Let's get Miles in on that, too.
And so I'm going to close. I did close public testimony. Thank you, Jim, for your help, and thank you, committee. We want to get on to HB 33. We've got people waiting on HB 104, and we don't want to get too far behind. So Representative Newman, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Mark Newman, and I represent House District 10, this portion of the beautiful Sitna River Valley. Mr. Chairman and members, just in researching and issues that we found in Alaska statutes, our Alaska Supreme Court has also, we've had an issue with some of the knives that we use, and it's an important issue to a lot of sportsmen in the area, nationwide, and quite frankly, a lot of people who are just outdoor recreationists and people who work with these knives could even be a sheetrock knife, you know, for some of the things we're doing. So we've introduced a bill, House Bill 33, which is a Knife Rights Act, clarifying that hunting, fishing, and utility knives which are easy to open with one hand, do not qualify as a switchblade and can be legally owned. Mr. Chair, these knives are an important tool for working Alaskans and found on many craftsmen for those people around the work in the house. But HB 33 will protect Alaskans to carry one of these pocket knives from running afoul of local laws, which has happened previously in the state, and so we're trying to help clarify that with our courts. The American Knife and Tool Institute states that there are over 35 million Americans who carry these types of easy open knives or one-handed knife in Alaska. Per capita is probably even higher than that. And about 80% of all knives sold nowadays are one-hand assisted opening knives. And we do have some samples of this, these types of knives, Mr. Chair, for the committee to look at for clarification on what we're doing here. And most of these knives, again, are spring-loaded in some way, but it does not make them a switchblade, and that's why we're adding language to clarify that. And again, a number of states have taken similar action. It's a preemptive type of a piece of legislation where courts have struggled with this. And again, our goal is to clarify this legislation, approve, provide clarity for the courts, and add a preemptive language reserving the state's rights. And Mr. Chairman, I would like to take note that we do have somewhat of a local expert on the committee here, an enthusiast, and I'm glad to say that he is a co-sponsor of my bill, and that would be Representative Grunberg, very knowledgeable about these issues. So thank you, Representative Grunberg, and the committee. And with that, if I could hand it over to my staff, they can explain the specifics.
Yeah. Go ahead.
For the record, my name is Rex Shattuck, staff to Representative Mark Newman. Mr. Chair and members of the House Judiciary Committee, HB 33 consists of four basic sections. Walk you through them real quick. Section 1 adds to Alaska Statute 1181-900B and two new paragraphs. Page 1, line 6 of the bill adds paragraph 65, which defines what a gravity or what gravity knives are, and page 1, line 12 adds paragraph 66, which defines what switchblades are. Looking at the bill itself, in defining gravity knives and switchblades, we also define what they are not. That's an important thing to remember as we go through. Section 2, on page 2, line 4, amends AS 2910-240 by adding to the present limitations of home rule powers over the regulation of knives or firearms, knives. So similar to what firearms, you now have knives. On section 3, page 2, line 6, it amends AS 2935-145A by adding, again, knives to the authority already reserved to the state to regulate firearms. And then finally, section 4 on page 2, line 11, amends AS 2935-145B by, again, adding knives to the same ordinances a municipality is able to pass on firearms. We've done two things. We've added what gravity knives and switchblades are and consequently what they are not. There are two places, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there are two places in Alaska statutes that address these gravity knives and switchblades, and they are in 1161-210-5, which is misconduct involving a weapons in the fourth degree, and then in AS 1161-220-5, misconduct involving a weapons in the fifth degree. Both of these use the terms switchblade and gravity knives, but there's nowhere in our statutes that it actually defines what those are, and those what those two paragraphs will do. Mm-hmm. As Representative Newman stated, there are several cases that that actually found there was insufficient definition. We provided a copy to the committee this morning with a legal memo further identifying those two cases. They were the State versus Weaver and the State versus Strange. Part of the problem comes from the Federal Switchblade Act of 1958 and its Title 15C, Chapter 29, manufacturing of transportation or distribution of switchblades, knives to in U.S. code. And so basically what that said was Section 1241B gave the following definition. It says, the term switchblade knife means any knife having a blade with which automatically opens. One, by hand pressure applied to a button or other device in the handle, or two, by operation of inertia or gravity or both. Those are very vague, especially as Representative Newman talked about the knives of the knives of today have devices on them that unlock them and allow you to open them, and that's what causes the confusion as to whether or not it's a switchblade. Now, the Homeland Security Act in an appropriations bill in 2010 went a step closer to helping to define what switchblades and gravity knives are, but it still sort of leaves us here in the state without the definition. Under Section 1244 exemptions, like we have in our statute and have added to, switchblades were determined not to be, and this gets closer to addressing what our concern is. Switchblades were considered a knife that not to be a knife that contains a spring, detent, or other mechanism designed to create a bias towards closure. And the bias towards closure is the key way to identify what is not a switchblade. And that it requires exertion applied to the blade by hand, wrist, or arm to overcome the bias towards closure to assist in its opening. We have some demonstrations, which probably at this point in time might be easier to sort of get into to help you understand what those are, if it's acceptable to the chair and members.
Go right ahead.
Okay.
Just don't cut your fingers off.
I shall. The most clearly and easily identified of switch, what we recognize as a switchblade, thanks mostly to Hollywood, is this knife here. It's a bench.
And these
I shouldn't say what the manufacturer's name is, but it's called an Infidel. And so with one switch on the side right here, if you push it, it comes out. And again, if you pull it, it comes back into it. Now, yes, ma'am.
Curious. So, you've got that knife. Did you have to get special permission from somebody in order to bring it here, or how does that work?
Ma'am, yes, this knife would be considered illegal for the average person to hold in our present statutes. There are exceptions in the Anchorage municipality to law enforcement and to military people. Now, the military is a little bit gray. The individual who's online, who is an owner of a store and sells these sorts of merchandise, can probably testify to it. Interstate commerce clause, the interstate aspect of this would allow you to go online, purchase this, and purchase it from another state. So I actually have this on hand receipt from them so that we could use it as a demonstration for you.
Just to follow up.
You going to press charges, Representative Ledoux?
No, I'm not. No. Somebody theoretically walk into, could Annie call somebody and somebody come up and theoretically arrest you for that? Just curious.
I'm not willing to answer that question. You're the chair.
For now, proceed.
Yes, I have it on receipt as for purposes of demonstration.
Press the button again then?
Yes. So slide the button up and it comes out. Slide the button back and it goes down. Now, there is some misconception that these knives, actually, if you held them against a person's string and pulled it, it would puncture you. It may do a little bit of a puncture, but if you look here, it sticks slightly into the paper and the blade now is sort of, if you slip it out, then it'll go back to functioning. Okay. That is the clearest definition of what a switchblade is. That fits our need. There are several other knives.
Want to see him? Go.
This is what we're trying to protect Alaskans from getting confused with as a switchblade. This knife right here is a very common type knife. It has a little locking mechanism right here, which is additional safety. The blade has two little pegs on the side, and it only opens to about that point, sprung to that point. If you notice, there's a little bias towards keeping it closed. That's why the bias closed language. What gets confusing is this. Okay? On the back side of it, there is a tang that comes out that I can use to help me open the blade. Okay? Now, the value of these is to the tradesperson, to the fisherman, and I think there are some that would have more nautical experience than I, that would tell you historically these sorts of knives were created for the purposes of sailors and cutting themselves from lines on a ship. Fishermen also use one-handed opening knives to be able to do the same thing. There are two other, there's one other knife to show you. This is the example of a gravity knife. If I move this slide back, notice it just falls out and there's no springing to it. It's not a very aggressive knife. It's a utility knife, but because you can flick it open like that, it fits under the category of a gravity knife. Again, one would ask, why is that illegal? That's not so much our question as much as making sure Alaskans who carry these in any sort of shape are not confused with them being switchblades. This is another example of a switchblade. It's a little grayer as to whether it fits that. This has a button on the side. If you press the button, it will fling it open. But unlike that one, it has to be retracted. There is a certain bias to closing it. In wrap-up, I'd like to just review HB 33 real quickly. It protects Alaskans who carry these knives from possible prosecution by doing two things. It adds to the statutes a definition of what is a switchblade and thereby what is not. Likewise with a gravity knife and what is not. And a bigger concern is the preemption language prevents jurisdictional issues that typically happen with firearms. So if a tradesperson got on an airplane in Fairbanks and was flying to a remote location or someplace else in the state, had crossed through different jurisdictions, they might find themselves having one of these sorts of knives in afoul of that particular statute in that area.
Okay, before we open it up to questions, we have, just so you know, if you want to call on them or the committee, we have Andy Carpenetti here from the Department of Law. We have John Tassin, I guess, is online from the Department of Law. And we have Rodney Dial, State Troopers, online for questions. And we just, we have one, two, I think three here that to testify from the public. So I think we're doing okay on time. And we'll just...
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Some of the folks that are here to testify are experts in the fields of knives, and maybe if they were allowed to testify, it may help clarify any questions that this committee may have.
Okay, you mean before we open up to questions? That's fine. So you are probably referring to Todd Rafter, maybe, from Knife Rights and
amongst
Arizona,
others.
Arizona Online. Todd, are you there? Yes, do you have a testimony on HB 33?
I do. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you for allowing me to testify today. All around the country, knife laws are being abused by local jurisdictions, most notably in New York City, where the definitions of knives are being used against otherwise law-abiding citizens to arrest and charge them with serious crimes. The police are arresting people for carrying a switchblade or so-called gravity knife when it is not actually a switchblade or gravity knife. This has become such a problem that my organization, Knife Rights, has sued the city of New York over civil rights violations. In a rural state like Alaska, it's not only common for a person to carry a knife of some kind, it's practically a necessity. The citizens of Alaska should not have to have a legal degree to determine whether the type of knife they carry daily is legal or illegal. HB 33 clearly defines what is a switchblade or gravity knife and what is not, eliminating confusion for both citizens as well as law enforcement. If Alaska decides to keep its ban on switchblade knives, then I would urge you to adopt these definitions so your citizens will know for sure what is legal and what is not. HB 33 does another very important thing. It makes the state legislature the sole authority on knife laws in Alaska, eliminating the potential for patchwork of various local laws. Most knife laws around the U.S. are at a local level, so Knife Rights has been working in numerous states to enact knife law preemption. We've so far been successful in Arizona, Utah, New Hampshire, and Georgia, and we also have bills pending in Kansas, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Texas, and a number of other states to enact knife law preemption. For those who are on the committee who may be concerned about local control, I'd like to add that when it comes to an individual right, like the right to bear arms, I would suggest the state has a very real interest in protecting individual rights. Preemption of local knife laws enables the state to protect that right consistently across the entire state. Again, I thank you for listening to my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Todd. See no questions at this time, so thank you so much for taking time out of your day to call. Ray Thibault.
Yes.
Did you have testimony on HB
33? Yeah, mine is fairly simple, and I agree with everything that has been said. I think it's all dead online. And just simply, as a retail cutlery store here in Anchorage, and we actively serve the entire state across all locations, from law enforcement to the marine fisheries and everything else. We're frequently asked to define what are switchblades and what are not, what's allowable, this, that, and the other. And I definitely agree that this HB 33 would help us in that regard by clarifying the definitions. It would make it vastly more simple and more clear-cut. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ray. Appreciate your testimony. Mike Coons, I'm going to... You called on HB 83, and I see you're also on for 33. So I'm going to include you with the knife experts here, and you go right ahead and give us your testimony. Are you on, Mike? Okay, he must be gone. That's fine. So I don't think there's anybody left in the room. I don't think I've missed anybody. Again, I did fail to point out that Alpheus Bullard is on from Legal Services if the committee has any questions, too. So are there any questions that the committee has? Representative Ledoux.
I'm just sort of curious in reading these cases that you supplied to us. Were these just law-abiding citizens who just went out and purchased knives and were, like, minding their own business and managed to get busted for this?
To the chair, Representative Ledoux, as you read through the case, there probably were other reasons why they were approached for and the discussion in court as to whether this was an additional charge.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ledoux, that's why we're trying to introduce this bill, is, you know, to clarify this, because there are people like you and I, you know, Representative Taylor, and many advocates here who are avid outdoorsmen or outdoors people. And again, 80% of all the new knives are assisted opening knives. And we're trying to make sure that their rights are protected, you know, from different municipalities or jurisdictions that may have different laws, by clarifying, again, in state statutes that this is a legal knife. And again, because it has been questioned in the courts, we've actually been asked to assist a little bit in that to try and clarify the language in it. Because we have not had clarifying language, and now this would make it so we do.
Okay. Follow up. I appreciate that, because I think I bought something like one of those knives at a Ducks Unlimited banquet.
You probably did.
And if you hauled it home, maybe you're in trouble. thank you, Representative Newman. And
perhaps through the chair, the question should be, does Representative Ledoux have that knife with her at this point?
No. I won't go there. Thank you so much, and we'll call you back up with those questions. With that, is there any questions or comments, I guess, between us and the committee? Or if not, I sure would welcome a motion just to get it out.
I'd be very happy to. So I'd like to thank the presenters here for demonstrating those knives. I haven't seen anything like that since I left East Los Angeles and Garfield High so many years ago. But with that, Mr. Chair, I would respectfully move House Bill number 33, 28-LS0194 /U with individual recommendation and a happy zero fiscal note. Okay.
Seeing no objection, we're going to take a brief time out while the paperwork comes and we get organized for the next round. We're waiting for now, and what we have is a blank CS in front of us. I'm going to need a motion to make it the working copy, but there's been enough changes, and there's been several of us involved in that, and we're going to have Tom Wright describe one change we made. I'm going to have Representative Pruitt describe another one, and then I think we may have an amendment coming. And the hope is to get, and Representative Lynn has a change in here, too, that he'll be explaining. So we'll start in that order. And so anyway, is someone move 104 for us, this version, please?
Is it version C?
Oh, Oscar, right?
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I would move CS of House Bill number 104, 28-GH1983/O for this committee's consideration.
For the consideration. See, no objection. We're just going to go ahead and we can discuss it. So, Tom, if you would come up.
Here it is. Now, where's the amendment I've got for this?
We didn't spend a lot of time describing the whole bill, did we? But let's go ahead and just hit the pieces here. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you need to look at the pieces, and then you can get the kind of binds the whole bill. For the record, my name is Tom Wright. I'm staff to the speaker. And this has been an amendment we've talked about for a while, and it really came to light last year when we had candidates who ran via petition. And what happens is those candidates only have to, they don't appear on the primary, they appear on the general ballot. They are also not subject to the same disclosure that candidates are, candidates of a recognized political party. So what this amendment does, and it's in section 24, 1525-150, what this amendment does requires a petition candidate, someone who's running from an unrecognized political party, to have to file their documents and their petitions by June 1st. By doing so, even though they might not appear on the primary ballot, they are subject to the same disclosure laws, campaign finance, especially with your 30-day reports, your 7-day reports, your 24-hour reports in the primary, as any other candidate who's from a recognized political party. And what this does is level the playing field somewhat, because if you're a petition candidate, you have access to all this information from the primary, how much money you've raised, who you've raised it from, what your expenditures are, and being involved in campaigns on my spare time, that information's pretty useful. And again, what this does is just level the playing field. So if you're a petition candidate, you have the same campaign disclosure laws as anybody else. The change is you're going to have to file your disclosures 30 days before the primary, 7 days before the primary, and any 24-hour activity before the primary.
Great. Sounds like a super improvement to the bill, and I want to point out that Division of Elections, Gail Fanumiai, is here, and I do not plan to move the bill today. So you don't have to give it any questions that come up. We'll have time to address them. Representative LaDuke.
Yeah, I think it sounds like a great idea, Mr. Wright, but I can't find it on my CS. So.
Mr. Chairman, it's on page 8, and it's line 25.
Page 8, line 25. Okay.
And I have had, Mr. Chairman, just so you know, I've had our legal counsel, Mr. Bullard, talk with the APOC attorney just to make sure that this does what we wanted it to do. At first, there was some doubt from APOC that this didn't do what we wanted it to do, but after it was discussed, with our legal attorney, they now know that this actually accomplishes what we want to accomplish.
Is there a due follow-up?
Okay, I'm looking at 1525-150, and it talks about the actual physical delivery of the petition. Where is it talking about the APOC stuff?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, it doesn't talk about the APOC, but having to file by that June 1st date subjects them to all the disclosure laws, the campaign finance disclosure laws, as any other candidate, even though they might not appear on the primary ballot. They still, by having to file by June 1st, they still have to file the 30-day, the 7-day, and the 24-hour reports during the primary.
Follow up?
What does this do if somebody is doing a write-in campaign? A write-in campaign they don't have to do by June 1st, it's my understanding.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, this does not cover write-in candidates. I don't know how we can do that, because anybody can file run as a write-in. We can't require them in my mind anyway, it'd be almost impossible to require them to have to file by June 1st. You know, I'll leave that to the discretion of the committee, but I think it would be a hard task to undertake.
Well, I guess since write-ins are becoming, you know, they're not right now. I mean, they're something that people can realistically do, as evidenced by past history. Could we have something said, how would you feel about it, that at the time that they are filing their write-in petition, or however you do it by write-in, that they have to file the disclosures?
I'd have to leave that up to APOC, but I don't think they are subjected to the same disclosure laws as a petition candidate or a candidate from a recognized political party. How you would do that, we're open to suggestions on that.
If you would, Representative Liddell, would you chase down that question and get back when it's on it? Because we will have the bill in here and pass it.
Yes, I will, okay. As a matter of fact.
Did you have a question, Representative Pritt?
No, I was actually going to, I think it was answered, but I was just going to make sure that it was clarified that currently someone who does petition is required under APOC, but because they're only required to file that petition, I think it's a month, I would have to correct me, before the date of the election, by adding it, making it June 1st, they were already subject to it. We're just now they're subject to the whole time frame. That's really the change that's made there.
Representative Grunberg?
Mr. Wright, through the chair, will this also require them to file their financial disclosure by the 1st of June?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of what date that has to take place, but yes, they would have to file their financial disclosure also within a specified time frame. And again, that's something you might want to ask of APOC, because I'm not really sure when those have to be filed by candidates who are from a recognized political party.
Thank you. May I continue, please?
Follow up.
If somebody loses, let's say there are three candidates in a House race, two Republicans and a Democrat. The Democrat goes through unopposed in the primary. The Republicans have a really tight race, and one of them wins by one vote and then moves on to November. Under current law, could that other person get a petition and be on the ballot in November?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, no. They have to file. They're going to run by a petition. They have to file by June 1st under this section.
No, I'm talking about under current law.
Under current law.
They have a date in which they have to file their petition, and I don't think, and again, I'll have to leave that up to Division of Elections, Gail Fanumii.
If I could, Gail, would you come up right now? That'll work.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot there.
No, and I'm not sure.
We'll find out.
Through the chair.
Thank you so much. State your name and give your response.
Gail Fanumii, Director, Division of Elections. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. Currently, a no-party candidate has to file their intent to be a petition candidate by June 1st. Their petition with signatures are required to be filed by 5 p.m. on primary election day. So the scenario in which you were bringing forth in front of the committee, they would not be able to run as a no-party candidate. Their option would be to run as a write-in candidate.
Representative Ledoux.
Could somebody who is on the primary ballot as a Republican or a Democrat or what have you, but also at the same time be filing their petition to run as a petition candidate, so that they can, you know, hedge their bets, so to speak?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, when a candidate files for office, they have to say they are not filing. They have not filed as a candidate for another office, or they're only allowed to file for one seat at a time.
Representative Ledoux?
But would that be one seat? Because they'd still be running for the same seat. So it wouldn't be like somebody's running for At the same time, they wouldn't be running for state representative and the state senate. They'd be hedging their bets. So in case they lost the primary for either one of those, like I think when Joseph, I can't remember the fellow, the senator, the former senator from Connecticut, Lieberman. He had a really tough primary that he thought he was going to lose. So at the same time that he was running in the primary, he had also was filing a petition to get on the ballot as an independent candidate, and he ultimately won that race. Do we have that option here to do something similar?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the petition statutes state that the candidate must say that they are not a candidate for any other office to be voted on at the primary or general election, that the candidate is not a candidate for this office under any other nominating petition or declaration of candidacy.
But it's not another office.
I just want to clarify that. I heard in part of that other office, but then I thought I also heard for this office, so I wanted just to make sure.
Through the chair, that is correct. Any office or for this office under any form of a nominating petition or declaration of candidacy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Representative Grunberg.
A couple of additional questions. I'm seizing on your amendment, but she's a target of opportunity. Gail, are you familiar with the concept of fusion?
That's from Gail, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, no, I am not.
Okay. Fusion is found in some states, not permitted in other states. Allows somebody to be nominated by more than one party.
Mine was by request.
So I could run as a Democrat and as a Republican in the district and receive the nomination of both parties. Earl Warren, in fact, did this in California when he ran for governor.
Page 7.
Does that all ring a bell? And by the way, the U.S. Supreme Court has held there's no constitutional right to do that if statutes don't permit that. I don't want to put you on the spot if that's not familiar with you. Okay. The next question is, in some states, I'm going to call it a Lyndon Johnson arrangement, that you can run for more than one office. For example, he was up, his Senate seat was up when he was on the ballot for president, and that way, had he lost, he could have won for the senator. Any comments on, is there anything that permits or prohibits that in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, you are, when you file your declaration of candidacy, you say that you are not a candidate for this office or any other office for the primary general election, either through a declaration of candidacy form or through a nominating petition process.
Okay, looks like we've exhausted the questions on this, at least for now. Thank you, Tom.
Oh, I do have one. I'm sorry. I guess maybe I shouldn't ask, or I should ask.
Representative Grunberg?
My question is, when do you have to, if you're running and you're not in office, when do you have to file your financial disclosure? And would this Section 24 amend that or have any effect on that? Yeah, but I thought she might know.
Gail knows everything, right?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so, but Representative Grunberg's statute says that a person filing a nominating petition who is filing a petition for state legislative office shall simultaneously file with the director a statement of income sources. So at the time they file their initial paperwork saying they want to be a nominating petition candidate, they must file their financial disclosure papers.
Okay.
That is the same as a recognized party candidate as well.
Okay. And I think, Representative Ledoux.
So, I guess I'll ask you the question about the APOC disclosures and a write-in candidate. How could you? Is there any way of requiring the write-in candidate to file the APOC disclosures that other candidates have to file at the same time that they're doing a write-in campaign?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm not an APOC expert. You would have to direct that question to somebody from Alaska Public Offices Commission.
Thank you.
I need to get some help on this. I don't know where we're going with it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. What I think we'll do now, I think it'll take the least time. I want to go to Representative Lynn, and Alpheus Bullard is online, and maybe you could show us and tell us what this, Representative Lynn or Alpheus, what the amendment is. Yeah, it's in the CS. It should be in the CS. Alpheus, you there online?
Chairman Keller and members of the committee, yes, I'm here online.
Thank you. Can you easily point out where the amendment is by Representative Lynn, and where it exists in version O?
Chairman Keller, I'm not sure which specific amendment you're referring. Can you name the amendment, please?
Yes, this is by request, and it's page 7, lines 11 and 13. Through CSHB 104 version C.1.
We're on O.
I know, but this amendment is here. We want to find out where it is.
See, the amendment version that he has here, we don't have in front of us, but it was one that was incorporated into the
Section 37.
Yeah. And it's Section 37 is where it is, and on the bottom of page 12 and the top of page 13.
So we're in Section 37, what, page 13?
Bottom between page 12 is where it starts. Page 12, line 29 through page 13, line 5.
Okay. Mr. Bullard,
certainly. Chairman Keller, members of the board, speaking specifically to Section 37 of this draft, what the section requires is the lieutenant governor to prepare and publish on the division's internet website a photograph and a statement of a candidate in office designated under A, B, or G of this section. Those candidates are...
Speak right into the mic, if you would, Alpheus.
Forgive me. This governs candidates for president, vice president, a candidate for United States Senator, United States Representative, State Governor, State Lieutenant Governor, State Senator, or State Representative, and then a judge for retention under G of that section. Yeah. In this, though, Section 37 just provides that the Lieutenant Governor will include these on the website, and if these are timely filed, that they will appear on the website at least 15 days before the pertinent election at which the candidate will appear on the ballot.
Okay. I think that answers it. And the committee, we're not going to act on the bill today, so we may have further questions, but that identifies where it is, and we will look at it further. But Representative Gruenberg has a question.
Just one question on one word for one witness. That's Ms. Finumiai.
If you would, come up, Gail. Again, identify yourself for the record, and Representative Gruenberg, go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you, Ms. Finumiai. I would like you to turn to page 13, the last page of the bill. Line 4. 15. Would it be possible, and if so, how difficult, to require published earlier than 15 days, if possible. Something, because you might have something that, you know, they submit this very quickly after the date they file, and this would give the public more time to see the statement and the photo. Could you do it earlier than 15 days?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the 15 days was put in there as a suggested timeline for a date that the division knew it could meet based on the fact that the majority of the pamphlet submissions are received on the very last day. And it takes a great deal of time to get those into published format and to say immediately upon receipt or that's not practicable for the division, and that's why we asked for this to be changed to 15 days, and then they all would be placed on the web no later than 15 days before the election.
I understand. I gather that's the earliest date the division felt comfortable with.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, that answered my question.
Okay, great. Thanks. Representative Ledoux.
Don't you now publish them well before 15 days? I mean, I thought I saw them up there, you know, quite a bit before the election.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, this the prior to the 2012 general primary election, the division had candidate information linked to the candidate list about 2 weeks before the election. The general election pamphlet is produced and published online about 3 weeks before the general election.
Thank you.
Okay. Gail, if you don't mind, if you're comfortable, just stay right there, because my guess is you're going to be, we'll have you right back up here. So with that, we're going to go to Representative Pruitt and let you exchange your good suggestion that you have.
Okay.
You know, it's in the CS.
You will find Section 27 and Section 28. Actually, it's a couple different sections that this is applied to, 29, 30, 31, 32. This what we're doing here is it came to my attention that upon a vacancy in our federal electorate, that basically what could happen is we could have it's just kind of a winner takes all. You could have 15 different people running. In the end, someone who hasn't necessarily gained the support of Alaskans ends up representing us. And so my thought process is let's give an opportunity for us to have the closest to a 50% that we can have possible. So what we're doing here is we've said that if someone does not get 50% of the vote in the initial that initial special election, that we will the top two vote getters will go to a special runoff election, and at that special runoff election, which will be within not less than 60 days before or after, sorry, that then those two would. Representative Lynn, it's quite a few places because there was a lot of conforming that we would go ahead and then have that special runoff election. Now, one of the things that I think you'll find in here it took me a minute to kind of figure out what was going on. We're trying to utilize, and actually they do already, but with the special runoff, we try to utilize if there's other elections taking place. Let's say there's a primary, a general, or even in the case of a potential ballot initiative or something, is to utilize those elections instead of having to create something separate from them. And a lot of the conforming language in here is applying to allowing it to be a part of those particular elections. So, for instance, if it was vacated in between a primary and a general, the initial runoff would be actually in the general election, and if someone did not get 50%, then there would be a special election that would be held with 60 days after, basically. So it's utilizing the elections that are there so we don't generate additional costs. That was something that Alpheus used, that he placed in, and he was using his knowledge and several other members over there. It's kind of confusing initially, but once he explained it to me, it made sense that we're just trying to utilize the other elections that exist. So,
Representative Ledoux, go ahead.
I'm not sure I understand this. So are we talking about, like, let's say there is a general election and there are three people running, there's an independent, there's a Republican, and a Democrat?
No, sorry. Let me thank you. What it's doing is, let's say that you're in a senatorial election, a senatorial term, 2 years into a senatorial term.
U.S. Senate or?
U.S. Senate. Sorry. This is only for federal. It's only for federal. 2 years into a six-year term, a special election would be called. Say they chose to go to another, they were appointed to some sort of secretarial position, chose to step down for whatever reason. Current statute would say that there would be a special election. And the current statute, I believe, according to Alpheus, also tries to utilize other elections if it's within a certain period of time of that election. Let's say that it was they stepped down less than 60 days before a primary election. They would try to utilize that primary election instead of having a whole separate election. It would be called on the same day. A special runoff would be 60 days after that if we did not hit 50%. and they would utilize, they would, in that case, let's say it was in a primary, they would try to utilize the general election. But it's not the same, it is still a special election, so it's not the same as a normal election would be, where you have Republican, Democrats, Independent, Green Party, all of that, because it was a special election.
So, can I?
Representative LeDuc, go ahead.
So, I thought that under the current scenario that the D's nominate one person and the R's nominate another person, or is this something that anybody can put their name into the hat and call themselves a D or call themselves an R, or don't you even put those things on the ballot for that?
Ms. Fimignani can correct me on it, but it's a winner take all. So it can be five D's, five R's, three nonpartisans. They could whatever. It's everyone in, and this is an opportunity for us to have the top two, then go to an actual runoff, so Alaskans can feel comfortable with. A lot more comfortable with the person that's representing them on a 50%. Unless they get 50%, then there's no need for a runoff. If one of those individuals gets 50% initially, then there's no need for a runoff.
Just so, if that 50% is so important, why wouldn't you want to do the 50% for any election? Why is I'm having a problem understanding why the special election is in a different category than the regular election, where we don't have a 50% requirement.
So this is kind of modeled. This is kind of modeled after what we do at the municipality level, because it's almost similar to it. Because a special election is not a primary system, it is in this case it is all everyone in. We were trying to use a model that existed to get to a point where Alaskans would feel comfortable with. Okay, a majority of Alaskans had voted for X person. So we used the 50% number that we used 50% as a number. I know in Anchorage they have 45%, but we're using 50% as a kind of just that mark for it. That then would send it to that special election. Now, let's be clear, you can still write in that special write-in or that special runoff. We can eliminate that if we chose to as a committee, but a write-in is available. So you could end up in the special runoff with someone with less than 50% if you had enough write-ins as well. So it's just a way to narrow down the people.
I understand that, and I understand the logic of it, and the logic may very well be good logic. I haven't quite made up my mind about that. But I'm trying to understand why it's important to do it in the special election, where it's not important to have that same requirement, as I'm sure you probably could have the same requirement with every election. I mean, we have elections here where there's a Democrat, there's a Republican, and there's somebody on the ballot by either a petition or a write-in, and maybe somebody doesn't get 50% of the vote. And you still, even though they don't get 50% of the vote in the regular election, we just assume that, they just get the office.
If I could, Representative Pruitt, and because in light of time, what I'd like to do is just record the question.
Yeah.
And then we will, talk further about it if you decide that you want to pursue the question when we hear the bill again. Part of the reason I'm pushing a little bit is that we have Representative Hughes out here, and I want to take at least the last few minutes to have her come up, because she has an amendment that is not in the CS that she would like to ask us to consider. And I'm not going to, we'll give you copies of it. We're not even going to move the amendment. I just want an explanation so we can be thinking about it for the next time that we do it. But I'm not shutting everything down here. Is there more questions first from Gail or from Representative Pruitt?
Can I just make one point?
Sure.
Just for Gabrielle's, because we don't have a primary in a special election, that's why.
Exactly.
It's the only reason why we would do the 50 plus, because we don't have a primary. There would be no primary. So I know it's hard to understand, but I just wanted to.
Yeah, that's right. That's
because exactly. There's no primary.
Okay.
That's exactly what I was about to say.
Why can't I come up with a short answer like that? Yes.
Thank you, Representative Millett.
I see no other questions this time, Lance, and we'll continue working this.
Yeah.
So, Representative Hughes, if you would come up and
Tell us. That, Mr.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
One thing this bill doesn't take up, and I know it's been an issue, and I mean, I'm not going to ask to do an amendment today, but I would like the committee members to think about it, is how we feel about running from a safe seat, because we could change
running
that.
From?
Running from a safe seat. Running as a vice president candidate, from a governor's seat, running from a Senate seat to a governor's seat. As you and I sit here today as House members, we never have the opportunity to run from a safe seat because we're up every 2 years.
But there are certain positions that do.
But if you are in the Senate, if you are in the lieutenant governor's, office, you can run from a safe seat. And so, I mean, if we're going to talk elections, let's talk fair and square and talk about, you know, that. I just want to put it in people's mind because running from a safe seat should be part of the conversation.
Okay. Well, let's all give that consideration and
conversation.
Representative Hughes, tell us what you would like to do to RCS. I left you all of 60 seconds here, 120 seconds.
And Representative Grimberg, we get to the letter of intent, too.
We will get to the letter of intent. I'm going to save 45 seconds for that. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. And I was in state affairs and heard this bill and had a question. The question was answered after the bill moved out, and so that's why I bring forward the amendment. And it pertains to page 4, line 23.
Are you talking about, excuse me, Representative Hughes, you're talking about the CS, version O?
Yes, I am.
Okay, page 4, line 23.
Yes, and it would be pertaining to absentee ballots, which must be it can only be counted if they're received by the 10th day. That is what the bill, the CS, proposes. And my suggestion for an amendment is to keep it at the 15th day from the day after the election, as is in current law. And the reason is that my question that I asked was how many ballots are received after the 10th day currently in the 2012 election. And I was told there were 18. Of those 18, 11 were considered valid. These were all overseas military and other Alaskans. And I know that is a small number, but those folks did mail their ballots, did have them postmarked by election day, and so those would be votes that would not be counted. And I believe that every vote should count if it's a valid vote, and that those submitting absentee ballots overseas should follow the same rules that we would here on U.S. soil. And I also want to make the point that a military person, particularly I'm concerned about them, they're going to be very busy. And in their mind, they're going to think about that election day as the cutoff. And they very well may cast their vote and mail it on election day. I want to make sure those are counted. And the Division of Elections suggested that it's pretty standard across the U.S. to go with this 10-day mark. Well, we're not standard. We're Alaska. We're unique. Mail takes longer to get here. And I believe that we should consider that. Also, the U.S. Post Office is planning, I believe, to reduce the number of mail delivery days from 6 to 5. So that's something we ought to take back. Also, if we're moving back the primary election, my understanding, the Division of Elections wanted this so that it would give them the extra time to prepare, print, and mail the ballots after the primary. If we're moving back the primary 2 weeks, they're already getting the 14 days. I believe they could probably moving it earlier, so they're getting those 14 days, and I think maybe they can do what they need to do without needing 19. And finally, I believe that the person should, again, have that right to mail it on the voting day, just like those of us in the U.S. Do. And I know that they're provided 45 days earlier, but that doesn't matter. They still should be able to vote on voting day. And it also doesn't matter that there's now electronic voting available. That's great. Those are all great, but that's irrelevant. They should have the same right as those of us here in Alaska.
And rather than go any further now, you know, unless there's any questions for clarification, the committee has the idea, and I'll leave it up to the committee whether or not somebody wants to pick that up and offer it. Gail Fanumia is here, and she will ask her before we adopt this, or take action on it as a committee. We're going to hear from the division, so that's
okay.
Where we're at in a
second.
Okay,
made
your case to the
committee. Can I make two little quick points? I was just handed that it's not just in the plan to move to the from 6 to 5 days. It is to begin in August 2013 to move to the five-day. And I forget what the other point I was going to make. So I guess that concludes.
Well, I'm sure that if somebody wants to pick up the amendment, that you can be sure you let Representative Hughes know right away and work with him, and so we can get all the fine points. And that way you won't have to come back unless you want to when this happens. So, okay?
If you want to explain this, you'll have to explain it again.
Okay. I'd be happy to do that. Okay. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm glad I was able to come. I didn't know that you were going to have me, so it worked out well. Thank you.
Okay. And then this letter of intent language you have in front of you for the committee for HB 63, is that language okay? Is there comments on
it? Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg?
I will, just so we have it in front of us, move the letter of intent. If somebody can object.
I'll object.
Thank you. This was drafted really by the bar at my request, and it asks the Supremes to increase the number of mandatory continuing legal education credits. Leaves it up to them. It's just a request. I move the amendment, letter.
And as long as there's an objection out there, I want to make a comment. This is not... to me, it's not germane to what the sunset change does, you know. And it isn't that I'm against what the concept, you know, and I'm not going to stand in the way if the committee wants to include this. But makes me a little uncomfortable, because we're sending part of the reason we acted quickly on the sunset was that it is just that. It's a change of a date, you know, to extend, and not necessarily one, you know, to change any policy with what's going on. But again, I, you know, you see the importance of it. You made your points. I heard you. You loud and clear. And I'm willing to do this. And I'm not going to, you know, it's Lance's objection, and I will not object. You know, go ahead. I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's very important that we encourage the bar to do this. And it's a good vehicle to do it.
Okay. So
I'll remove mine.
Okay. Any other objections? Okay. We got the letter of intent. That was easy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was just over 45 seconds.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. We're gaveled on 5 after 3.